This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a different feel today as we hear not from a World War II veteran, but from someone who is telling their stories, and has been for quite some time. Best-selling World War II author Alex Kershaw is with us. If you haven't read any of his work, there's plenty of it to keep you occupied during this pandemic. Blood and Champagne, about a combat photographer. The Longest Winter, about the Battle of the Bulge. Escape from the Deep, on the submarine USS Tang. You heard him mention The Bedford Boys, about the small town in Virginia that paid a heavier price than any on D-Day. And speaking of D-Day, his book, The First Wave, a D-Day masterpiece that came out about a year ago, is available now in paperback. I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and you can always find Alex's work at alexkershaw.com. If you're on Twitter, I think you'd really enjoy what he posts. You can feel his sincere admiration and reverence for the veterans of World War II and what they did for the rest of us. And Alex, I understand you're working on a book now about the 3rd Infantry Division. I'm thinking that's a pretty massive undertaking because of how long that division was in combat in World War II and how much ground the 3rd Infantry Division had to cover.
The distance is over 2,500 miles from the deserts of North Africa, Casablanca, all across North Africa, Sicily, Italy, southern France, all the way up the Rhone Valley into the German border, through Germany, and then right to the very southernmost part of Germany in the Alps. So 3rd Division, you know, not many people know that they did that they were in combat for 635 days. That's longer than any other American division in Europe. It's 100 days longer than any other division that even comes close. Lost the most men. The turnover in men was the highest. They had the largest number of casualties. And interestingly, because they spent so long in combat, they also received the largest number of Medal of Honors given out in World War II. So the 3rd Division had 40 men that received the Medal of Honor, more than half of them posthumously, but that's a hell of an achievement. It's 40. And the Glamour Boys, the 101st Airborne, that, you know, the basis of Band of Brothers, those are the guys that won World War II, aren't they? Fantastic division, but 117 days on the line and just 2 Medal of Honors. So there's no comparison. I mean, in terms of getting the job done, in terms of liberating Europe, in terms of like the tough, grinding battle, it was the 3rd ID that gave the most, I believe, of any American infantry division in World War II. So I'm writing about 3 or 4 guys from one regiment, from Audie Murphy's regiment, who fought all the way through to the very end. Audie Murphy's one of them, although he's not the main focus. But right at the end, there were guys that had won were so decorated that the 3rd Division newspaper, called Frontline, started reporting on Murphy and a couple of other guys as if they were in a sports competition, as if it was a race to get, you know, the most medals. But there were guys in that unit, the 15th Infantry Regiment, that won every single medal. The first guy in American history, and he's one of my characters. And I'm writing about him this morning, actually, just before you called me. I'm on Mount Rotundo in November 1943, and the 15th Infantry Regiment with Audie Murphy and others are fighting very, very hard in the mountains, the Apennines in Italy, against the Germans, and they're losing a lot of guys, and they're stalled. They've basically been halted. And there's a guy called Morris Britt who played football for the University of Arkansas. Then he played one season, I think, in the NFL for the Detroit Lions. He's a hell of an athlete. And Morris Britt became the captain of K Company in the 3rd Division. And he became the first American ever, this is astonishing, he became the first American ever to earn every single medal for valor in one war, and that's the Second World War. So he went Bronze Star, Silver Star, BSC, and Medal of Honor, and he was the first American to win all those medals in one single conflict, and that was World War II. He won the Medal of Honor in November 19... His actions, rather I should say, were in November 1943 in Italy, and he was then, after being very badly wounded in Anzio, actually losing his arm, he was sent back to the US to recuperate and was a superstar. We've not been forgotten about him now, you know. I mean, unless you're a Detroit football fan or from the University of Arkansas, you know, you don't know this guy's name. But the name, I'll repeat it, Morris Britt, Captain Morris Britt. It was the first American to win every medal for valor in any war. So, yeah, I'm writing about him and Murphy and a couple of other guys. There's one another astonishing guy called Michael Daly. He was 20 years old. Again, he was a junior officer, company commander, and he won the Medal of Honor on the 18th of April, 1945, in the bloody ruins of Nuremberg. He was one of the last guys in the U.S. Army to receive the Medal of Honor in World War II, and barely survived. He was shot through the head, shot through the face, rather, on the 18th of April, 1945, having performed actions that earned him the Medal of Honor. So he was in the same infantry regiment as Murphy. They knew each other in World War II. So it's a kind of ultimate brotherhood I'm writing about. You know, guys that served in the same unit that were the most decorated and saw the most combat and came home and lived to tell the tale. You know, and they were so-called superstars because they had that Medal of Honor around their neck, but the weight of that medal was immense. It was crushing for some of them. You know, they came back and they were utterly traumatized. They were very badly affected by PTSD. They'd been broken in many ways inside, and it was a real ordeal to try and readjust to peacetime, let alone being treated like a saint and a superhero wherever you go, and you're only in your early 20s. I mean, Michael Daly was 20 years old when he received the Medal of Honor, had been in combat since Omaha Beach on June the 6th, 1944. Audie Murphy was, I think he was only 20 years old at the end of the war, 21, Medal of Honor recipient. These are very young people. My son's 22. These guys had been through hell for an awful long time, and they were still younger than my son when they came back from World War II, and then were expected to just get on with it and, you know, act like the poster boys for courage and bravery and do no wrong and go back to a job and work 9 to 5 and be good middle-class Americans and put the war behind them and never show anger and remorse or how heartbroken they really were or how destroyed so much of their faith in humanity and their psyche had been by seeing what they did. I'm writing about guys that are fighting like cavemen. That's what Murphy described it as, the fall of 1943 in Italy. They were so tired, so exhausted, so the conditions were so difficult that they really were, it was a battle of savages. It was primeval. It was about which guy's instinct was better than the others. Did you have the gumption? Did you have the basic human instinct to be able to detect the enemy before they detected you, and then could you then kill the enemy before they killed you? Were your ears sharp enough? Was your eyesight good enough? Were your instincts good enough? Could you stay quiet? Could you stay on your feet? Could you stay awake? Could you function in complete survival mode for day after day after day and stay alive? Because all the time people were trying to kill you. So I think that, you know, if you have been through that, and I haven't, thankfully, but quite a few people that I've interviewed over the years have been through that, and that's something that never leaves you, and it's hard to move beyond that. And I think Michael Daly, for example, went back to a reunion of the 3rd Division, went back to his old regiment many years later in Germany, and he said that, you know, that as he got older, as he got into his 70s, the memories got stronger. The memory of what he'd been through when he was just 20 years old, those memories became so much more powerful as he got older. They didn't fade at all. They became more distinct. They were sharper. They were more meaningful when he looked back on his life. And I think that's what I find with several of the veterans that I've spoken to in the last few years, is that the moments they remember are so vivid. They stand out above so much else in their life, you know? So yeah, the memories become more powerful. The emotions become more powerful. They can look back and realize just how important those bonds were to others. They can remember what it did to them. They know that they are a product of that, that in their essence, in their deepest essence of who they are, that was something that was very, very formative. So, yeah, no, I think it's all about what this thing does to human beings. And yet, you know, I think that one of the things that I'm always left with is that, you know, people that were there, if you were liberated Dachau on the 29th of April, if you were there and at the end of the war, if you'd survived Okinawa, if you had come through this and you were there at the end and you came home, that there was nothing that would ever make you feel more proud. These are moments that shone like beacons in their lives, that were these immense moments of historical importance that people could feel so immensely proud of today and always have. But to be able to say, I was there, I did it, I was part of that, I was there on Omaha Beach. I was there in the Battle of the Bulge. I was there when Dachau was liberated. I stood in that concentration camp 75 years ago, almost to the hour, and I looked at what the Third Reich had done to civilization, and I was a liberator. I brought hope that what I had done was something so extraordinarily monumental and good. That's a great thing to be able to carry with you, even, you know, when you're 95, 97 years old, you know?
Well, and I've always been moved by the juxtaposition, the duality of that, that there is this pride of accomplishment, there's this satisfaction, especially now that it's being recognized and that people get it and maybe understand a little more, but it's balanced out by that humility of spent a lifetime feeling like I didn't do as much as someone else did. I got to come home, and those guys back there are the real heroes.
This is interesting because, you know, I was asked that question on live TV on June the 6th for the 75th anniversary. I think it was by CBS, I can't remember, MSNBC, someone was filming veterans in the graveyard at Colville Seminary. Very powerful scenes, you know, 9,000 dead Americans in that one graveyard above Omaha Beach. And someone said precisely that, you know, I fought, I came home, but the real heroes are the ones that are buried here. You know, and that's repeated by many people. And I think Audie Murphy was like one of the first famous World War II veterans that actually said that. He says, you know, devoted his book to the guys who didn't come home. And you hear that all the time. But that really is a kind of like honorable modesty. It's the sort of thing that you would expect someone that was decent and a good guy to say. But the fact is that I will disagree on this one point alone. I have interviewed dozens of people who are superstar heroes that went through so much combat and were just really damn lucky that they lived. They were also heroes. They are also heroes, but they would never call themselves that. That's universal. I think anybody that's been in combat would never call themselves. There's somehow something kind of, I don't know, distasteful about calling yourself a hero. Other people can do that, but you don't call yourself hero when you've been in situations where people that you fought with have died. So, yeah, but I would disagree on that one point. I was sitting there thinking, like, well, hang on a second. You know, there are some people that are still alive who, you know, couldn't make the flight to Normandy, didn't get to go to that graveyard, who did remember what it was like to be in the 29th Division, the 1st Division, the 4th Division, who do remember the hedgerows of Normandy and how, you know, they were basically like 1 out of 10 of them were still alive by the end of that summer of 1944 after D-Day. They do remember it. It's probably, they still have nightmares about it. And they are heroes. And they, you know, it's just, I don't know. I think my point is that, yes, the heroes, obviously, they're left behind. But there are also amazing heroes that came back. So I think that's it's a kind of modesty, but we shouldn't forget that amongst us today are superheroes. I mean, that's, you know, that's all you can call them, really, you know?
Amen. I felt that modesty, that humility only underscores how heroic and exemplary they really are. Some of the veterans we interview on this show give me a hard time about calling it hometown heroes. It really can make them uncomfortable. But I think you just explained very eloquently why they are heroes to the rest of us and why it's important that we continue to shine a light on what they did so long ago. It's break time again, but there's more to come with best-selling World War II author Alex Kershaw. I guess we should find out when that book about the 3rd Infantry Division is coming out, right? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.